Today is July 24th, 2017, and we're here with Michael and Professor Joseph talking about Ghana.
Okay, very good. Continuing the narrative on Ghana, and what I'm going to do today is, looking forward to the conversation we're going to be having sometime in the next couple of weeks, hopefully with Dr. Richard Asante of Ghana, to talk about the recent elections and the current politics in Ghana. But also putting Ghana into the framework of what has happened in Africa during the past 30 years. And of course, we're focusing on that first decade. But so a couple of things, I wanted to say in reviewing the information. The first is that in these sessions we're talking about peace and democracy initiatives, and in my mind I was separating the peace initiatives, Liberia and Ethiopia, from the democracy and Sudan, and the democracy initiatives in Zambia and in Ghana. But in fact, looking at the documents is how much Ghana basically fell between a straightforward democratic transition and a conflict resolution and a conflict avoidance operation. So the issue of force and violence was just very present in Ghana in the lead up to the 1992 elections and continuing for some time afterwards. As I mentioned earlier, the nature of the Rawlings regime, this was a regime that really saw itself as a revolutionary movement in power, and which had used considerable force against the opposition and anybody who was seen as a risk. And that threat of violence persisted through the election process, as I mentioned. And some of the reports you've been able to look at show how much protests were coming in about the presence of violence. So, as we assess and evaluate the Ghana experience, it really takes on increased importance in how extraordinary it was to have been able to go through that process without any real large-scale flare-up of violence, and also to have a situation in which you now have a two-party system alternating in power. So the PNDC went through a process of its own conversion into a constitutional organization, a constitutional political party organization, shedding a lot of its paramilitary elements. Of course, gradually stripped away was There were just so many items of what was called repressive legislation that the regime had put on the books, gradually stripping that away, gradually restoring, you know, free access to the media and freedom of movement and all of the rights and so on. You know, you could contrast Ghana in that respect with a country like Uganda, which has never carried through the kind of transition that has occurred in Ghana, just to give you a sense of the gains. But anyway, that very extraordinary achievement. Now, from that perspective, I wanted to, you know, since we're talking about the Carter Center and we're talking about, you know, my personal insights, and, you know, obviously I was representing the Carter Center for a lot of the work that the Carter Center did in Ghana, but President Carter had his own agenda, and he had his own relationship that he had built up with Jerry Rawlings, and that was not the case with me or with between myself and any, well, I shouldn't say any, because there were a few members of the Rawlings regime who had been brought in as the government started moving to a more liberalizing posture. And one of them, his name shows up in the documents, Mohammed Ibn Chambas, who was a university professor, brought in, I believe, as a deputy minister of education, and then has gone on to serve in foreign policy positions, both in Ghana and with in international positions. So Mohammed Ibn Chambas was, you know, the one person I clearly remember from the government in which, you know, we could talk on pretty much even terms. But with most of the stalwarts of the regime, that was just not the case. So let me mention two particular incidents that really brings out, you know, some of this duality. And when I say duality in terms of representing the Carter Center and having my own personal views, and secondly, the duality between a regime that that rested on command of the use of force, had its own ideological positions, and its ideological positions was very much in line with what was called in the era so-called single-party democracy, but not certainly rejecting the idea of democracy as involving or requiring an open contestation for power. All right. The first incident that I'm recalling here, for the record, took place most likely shortly before the elections on November 3rd. And I was, you know, summoned for a visit. And I can't remember all the specific details, but I remember that Dr. Chambas is the one who came to collect me, and I was taken on this meeting. I had been on similar meetings. I'd gone to meetings involving Kojo Chikata, who was the security chief of Rawlings, and there was always usually an ear of sort of menace, of a certain, you know, intimidation to those conversations. But I mean, I was not intimidated. But this one was even a little more glaring. There had been a report of someone, I think it was either a bombing incident or somebody had had chemical thrown on them, but it was a case where somebody had been very badly injured, and burned. And to give you a sense of of what the, you know, what the atmosphere was like. I remember, you know, not being told where I was being taken, but in fact I was taken to a hospital, and in that hospital was, and I was taken to the bedside of this person I'd been reading about in the papers, who was a victim of this attack. And you know, and if, so if you could imagine, here senior government officials along with myself being taken to this bedside to see this individual, and you know, just expressing my condolences and my regrets for what he had experienced and so on, and now I remember, and then being taken to a meeting with Kojo Chikata. Now, all right, so what's going on here? There's great, of course, growing anxiety on the part of the regime about the elections, and the you know, concerns about, you know, the how, I wouldn't even say neutrality, because, you know, we stood out from the other, except for our partner, the National Democratic Institute of the U.S., we stood out from our other, the other monitoring organizations as taking a very rigorous approach. We would think being very professional and neutral, but that's not how the regime saw us. It really saw us at that time as a threat. Now, why a threat? Because the process was going to be a flawed process. It could not be other than a flawed process, because the government had resisted the creation of a new register. The register of voters was a register of voters it had drawn up for its own purposes, having to do with district assemblies and, you know, other electoral events that it was involved in. The Electoral Commission was, it was called the Interim Electoral Commission at the time, and it was, there were people on it who were, you know, professional, neutral, but it certainly was slanted towards the administration side in terms of the appointment. So there was a lot that the opposition saw that was stacked against it in terms of this process. So any attempt to shift the balance towards a more even playing field, as the opposition thought, was something that the government did not desire. From my notes, I see that the opposition was demanding that the, requesting that the elections be for president and parliament be held simultaneously, and this did not go through. The regime, you know, deciding what it thought was in its favor. The second incident I will mention, just to give you a sense of the, you know, my personal position in this process, and that of the Carter Center as such, was a meeting that took place, I believe, I don't know the exact, I'll have to see in my notes, but it was either in 93 or 94, earlier in 94, probably 93, given the heat of the occasion. But this was a meeting that involved, you know, President Carter on one of his regular visits to promote his broad agenda in Ghana, and a meeting involving Rawlings and his associates. Anyway, we were all gathered there. You know, I positioned myself very much to the rear of the gathering, because by that time, you know, I was known, and I knew that the you know, that the regime was you know, very very sensitive about, maybe that's too mild a word, very not pleased with the role that I was playing, basically to you know, to advance what we saw as the basics of the process. Anyway, during the course of this meeting, and Rawlings was speaking, and usually when Rawlings starts speaking, he just sort of hold the, you know, he's like, you know, a Chavez type leader. He starts speaking and then he just keeps going. And then I noticed the drift of his remarks, that his remarks, you know, I suddenly realized that these remarks were targeted at me, because he was now going through a lot of praise about the government and what it had accomplished, and the fact that there are people who come and who don't understand what's going on, and so on. And then there was a pause in the meeting, and President Carter looked over at me, and I just, I mean, this has happened before, and I just took this as my invitation to respond. And so I responded by, you know, saying the things that I've been seeing in Ghana and on the media, a lot of praise for what had been accomplished, that there had been difficulties, but, you know, considering the elections, there had been a major step forward. And then I took a moment to become very personal in responding to Rawlings. And there are two things I recollect I said. And first is that I had a long association with Ghana. So it wasn't that I was, you know, showing up and wasn't aware. I'd been coming to Ghana for quite a while. And then I mentioned two persons in that connection. I mentioned somebody who would be known to many people in the room. His name is Thomas Hodgkin. And I mentioned that Thomas Hodgkin was my professor at Oxford, had introduced me to the study of African politics. But I also mentioned that Thomas Hodgkin was an associate of Kwame Nkrumah, you know, the first leader of independence in Ghana. And not only that, that he was the founding director of the Institute of African Studies at the University of Ghana, Lagos. And then the second thing I mentioned was that, yes, that, you know, I used to come to Ghana when teaching at the University of Ibadan, because one of my close friends from Oxford, his name is Eric Bafour, you know, a Ghanaian, and we were colleagues. In fact, he was also in my college at Oxford, New College. But then I mentioned that Eric Bafour was also the godfather of my eldest son. So I spent a few moments telling Rawlings, basically, you know, that, you know, if I'm here, I'm not just somebody sort of arriving from the outside. I was somebody who have a very deep involvement with Ghana. And let me just say one other thing, because one other document that I read through this morning, and like I said, there's just such an incredible wealth of documentation. But I just read through my handwritten report on a meeting which I believe took place in 1989, and if, you know, I have 8 there, so it might be August of 1989. But anyway, in that meeting, it's a meeting I described when President Carter visited, and, you know, and participating in that meeting were two people. You know, there were a number of people, but two other key people in addition to President Carter. One was Mr. Sasakawa, the Japanese who was funding this Global 2000 program, very much focusing on agriculture and increasing the variety of maize and what we would call nowadays, you know, genetically modified seeds that, you know, have a lot of various values to them. And the other person was Norman Borlaug. And Norman Borlaug, you know, who was, you know, noted for the Green Revolution. And they were both in the meeting. And so I have my notes, and it's very interesting because I'm taking my notes of, I have notes of Rawlings speaking and Rawlings presenting his views and his very, you know, populist, nationalist views, and, you know, criticizing, you know, the Western governments and, you know, Western societies and what they had done and so on, and praising Carter and praising Sasakawa and praising Borlaug because they, like him, were more concerned, you know, had a humanistic vision, more concerned with the development of the society and so on. And then he talked about the elections they had conducted for district assemblies and the fact that the government was carrying out a decentralization program, right? And so that the, you know, what Carter, Borlaug, and Sasakawa were promoting, namely how to improve the livelihoods of the generality of Ghanaians, how that coincided with his view of what he was doing, you know, both in these realms and politically. So I'm just mentioning in that to you to show that, you know, there was a conversation taking place here and a relationship building up between Carter and Rawlings, concerned with, you know, these other programs about which the Carter Center, held in, you know, in high regard. And so my work in really focusing on the democratic and human rights agenda was, you know, a little a tangent. I mean, it was under the umbrella of the Carter Center, but it was a little at a tangent of what was the real focus and commitment of the Carter Center during those days. All right. So somehow or other, we managed to work through all of the frictions and all of the, you know, the tensions and so on, and to the end where, of course, you know, relations are excellent between, you know, the Carter Center. And one of the things I want to say about the United States, because I was able to find the figures, and this was about the U.S. government itself. Okay, bear in mind now as we're. And the figure I actually came up with the actual figures I have about the contributions leading before the elections, and the U.S. showing its great distrust of, you know, the feelings of the U.S. government towards Rawlings, and Rawlings towards the U.S. government was equally shared. Just, you know, lack of trust, and so there was a million. I think kronas from the Danish government. I mean, there was you know, several hundred thousand from other European governments, also from the you know, from the you know, in terms of sterling from the British government and from the European Commission, which it was at the time. From the United States, those, see, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, all right? So altogether millions of dollars. Of the amount of money at that stage, and I could get the exact date in 1992, the U.S. government, probably through USAID, had provided 20,000. And that was 20,000 of a requested 50,000. And that money was really just intended to go towards helping clean up the register, provide supplies, and so on. It was as minimal as you could imagine a contribution. And that gives you an idea of the huge gulf at that time between Rawlings, you know, and the U.S. government. Okay, so I'm giving you, a number of points here about that process, what took place, and you know, you're able to read a lot of the details in terms of how the elections actually proceeded. You know, you've been able to read the stolen verdict document and a lot of the, you know, commentary subsequently. Let me just read one last thing that I pulled out here. Now, it's the only time I'm reading something actually written. And this is dated from February of 1993, all right? So this is a good 4 months or so after elections. And this is a report that I sent to President Carter about several countries, but about Ghana, I'll just just read what I'd said here. I said, the combined opposition parties have announced that they will constitute an extra parliamentary opposition and not disrupt the work of the new Rawlings government. All right, this is after they had boycotted. And then I go on, we have succeeded in our active diplomacy to help prevent the electoral dispute from resulting in violent clashes between the two sides. We will carefully explore what further role we can play in the initiation of discussions on the reform of electoral procedures and arrangements to give the opposition some entry into the political institutions before the expiry of the first term of office, and that would have been in 1996. Mm-hmm. All right?
Yep.
So, over to you. Any questions?
I don't know if I have any questions. We've covered the 92 election in, I think, two or three sessions already.
Right.
So I think I'm...
You're pretty good. You have a good hold on it?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, that was about it. I don't know if you want to speak, specifically about any other part of the 92 election, like any substantive thing about either the voter register or whatever. But like I said,
no.
I have a good...
I don't need... We have... No, there's just a lot of information, just about the elections. I also want to mention in this connection for the record... And I showed you just some of the documents because, the partnership that the Carter Center was involved in, and two organizations in particular played a huge role, alongside ourselves. And in many ways, they played a somehow more substantive role in terms of the process. We were really dealing a lot with the more general, political diplomacy, using President Carter's prestige to keep advancing the process and so on. But one of them was the National Democratic Institute, mm-hmm. all right, which had its people on the ground, planning for a parallel vote count and so on. And the second was the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, mm-hmm. IFES. Yeah. And they played a huge role. In fact, their pre-election report of 1989, when they actually sent a team in, and then produced a report, and it was very detailed on what are all of the deficiencies that we were facing in, and the, other groups and so on were facing in Ghana, and what were the things that needed to be done to be able to, to have a reasonably fair process. I mean, and they really laid it out in that document, mm-hmm. right? And that document really became the basis for both the government, the opposition, a lot of professional groups, and of course the other monitoring organizations in, how much, what is the distance that need to be bridged, right, before we could get to that. Of course, it was not possible to bridge all of that distance. We bridged, enough of that distance. As far as the opposition was concerned, and you can see some of those other documents, the opposition was not pleased. They would have liked the Carter mm-hmm. Center to come out and just declare that the process was, was a very flawed process. And of course, they would have liked to have a complete rerun of it. That wasn't our call. And in retrospect, I think we made the right call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah. Speaking of other monitoring groups, can you... Yeah. Speak briefly about the Commonwealth Observer Group?
Yeah, well, the Commonwealth Observer Group, one thing that comes back very clearly to me, I remember a dinner that we had before the elections with some members of the Observer Group. And I don't remember his nationality, it would be in the notes. But I always remember that conversation, which was a conversation in which, it was very clear that they were not here to do any real serious kind of monitoring or so on, of the process. That they were, here to, basically give a stamp of approval. And I remember there was even a little bit of an exchange during the course of that dinner to indicate that, this is not how we were approaching it. Now, subsequently, the Commonwealth became much more organized and professional and independent, in carrying this out. But again, remember, these early elections in the early 1990s mm-hmm. were where in which they were not. So, Ghana was a member of the Commonwealth and, a member in good standing, and the people who were appointed to these Commonwealth missions were people who had been, senior diplomats and served in a lot of capacities and so on. They were not used to coming in and being, playing a somewhat confrontational role.
Mm-hmm.
We were, in that sense, much closer to, the sort of civil rights professional community in how we approach this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I can see about them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, man.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Good enough.
Yeah.
So.